Welcome to the award-winning Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cook 100 Degrees, boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. It's modern, it's useful, it's very cool, it's energy efficient, more energy efficient than a kettle, I'll have you know. A beautiful bit of kit. I love mine. If you can afford one, I recommend it. Go to cooker.co.uk for more details and to look at their design. Cooker, spelled Q-U-O-O-K-E-R, Q-U-O-O-K-E-R.co.uk. On today's hour, I'm taking you for a ride into the future. I have my crystal ball. I'm going to cold read you and pretend I'm talking to the dead so I can read your future. I'm not actually, no. Really, I have futurist Tom Cheesewright back on, and you know how I love to talk to him about the future, so we'll be doing that. But as well as that, Tom has set up a course to teach you, basic you, the listener, little old you and little old me, a course to how to predict the future. He's going to teach us how to do it. This is his advert he recently put out on social media. Want to think like a futurist? Yeah, I do. Get ahead of the game. That's me. Be first to explore new opportunities and threats. Oh, I do need to know the threats. Well, anyway, Tom says, I'm launching a course with Changing the Game Academy for leaders and managers who want to advance their skills in foresight, planning, and strategy. I read that and thought, I want a piece of that, but I want to know how it works. I love Tom. I love what he does. And I must say, I've been talking to him now for quite a long time, and a lot of what he says comes true. So it's not just mumbo jumbo, crystal ball, talk to the dead, cold calling, cold reading stuff. Definitely not. He knows his stuff. Let's find out how he does it. Where's his magic tricks? Has he got cards up his sleeves? Is it mirrors? Is that what he's doing? Is he distracting you? Sleight of hand. By the way, this will probably be like an advert for Tom's course, because obviously he's going to big it up, and I like him, so I'm sure I'm going to err on the side of going, I want a piece of this. But as I always say, I think you are wise enough to make your own decisions as a discerning listener. Whether you want to get involved in something, don't blame me. It's up to you. You've got to think through that. And I think this about everything. You know, whilst I'm here, don't be influenced by celebrities telling you to buy something or I'm wearing this or I'm drinking that. Well, I better do it because ex celebrities. I wonder how influenced I am by that. I really do. I like to think that I have no influence from that stuff at all. But there might be something there, and I do every now and then think, I wonder if I'm being influenced by people, by a celebrity, by what, I don't know, whatever. Maybe we need to do a podcast on that. But for the time being, let's talk to Tom Cheesewright. Here he is. Tom, how are you? Always great to speak to you.
Yeah, good, thank you. I have joined you in the inevitable with regards to the hair. It's gone. But other than
head.
That, all good. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
I'm
visibly older than I was only 5 years ago. 5 years ago, I did not wear glasses. I had hair. Even if I was clinging onto the hair back then.
Do you know what? It's one of those things it's quite a shocking thing to do when you look in the mirror, isn't it? You shave your head and you look in the mirror, and every time you do it, you go, oh, Christ, look at me. Look, I used to have a forehead of hair, but you eventually get used to it. And then the benefits outweigh the downsides to it, because it's just so easy to get ready every morning. Just no hair to do or anything.
So, yep, it's very straightforward. I like the sort of the utility of it.
That's right. Now, just in my intro there, I was talking about, obviously we're going to discuss your course, and I said to people, don't be influenced. Make up your own decisions. I always say that to my listeners because I think it's important if I'm discussing things. And then I wondered how often I was influenced. And I wonder if you've got anything on that for us. I'm thinking more like, you know, people, the celebrities, when they start sort of telling you to do things, or I wonder, because I feel that I look at it and go, I don't give a shit what you think. I'm not going to buy your stuff. But maybe I am being influenced. What do you think?
I think you are. I think the nature of influence has changed a lot over the last few years. Now, these numbers are a few years out of date, but about 6 years ago, I did some work for Salesforce, massive tech company. And one of the things they do is they have a piece of software that underpins all the websites you shop on, particularly fashion websites, actually. They've got lots of customers in the fashion world. And so we were looking at the future of retail. And so we surveyed, I can't remember now, maybe 8,000 16 to 35-year-olds around the world, in part about what influences their buying decisions. And what was really fascinating was you could see the decline of television as an influence. It was having less impact, albeit still very much measurable. But what was the standout winner amongst all of the options we gave people was friends and family. You are most influenced by the people close to you, the people you trust, the people you want to emulate and be like, the people who almost sort of validate your sense of cool and what's right and what's good. And so they are far and away the biggest influence. So if you're going to be cautious about any influence, be cautious about your mum and dad and your brothers and sisters and your friends and following the herd.
Do you know what? That's very true. I don't want to talk about it here, but there's a few examples where I realized that my family have heavily influenced me, probably in a bad way, but they meant well. And that's really interesting you should say that. But you do care about their opinions, I suppose.
Absolutely. You know, they've got both the frequency of touch to you. They're close to you, so you hear that message reinforced a lot. But also, like you say, you care. They've got a big weight of impact as well.
The one time that I really thought, everyone's going to laugh at this because it is such a weird thing, but I realized that at one stage when I was on Sky Sports, that it seemed that every celebrity had a yellow Live Strong arm bracelet. Do you remember those? What's that cyclist called?
Lance Armstrong.
Yeah. So they all had Live Strong. Do you remember they had the yellow rubber?
Yeah,
thing,
yeah.
Right. And that they were the first to really go on that trend. But I remember seeing like every now and then there was like another celebrity with one. And I was on TV and I was thinking, I kind of need to get one of those because otherwise it was before everyone in the general public had them. It was kind of this thing that was, they did a really good job on that because I think they gave them just to loads and loads of celebrities. And I was thinking, I've got to get my hands on one of those. And I remember managing to pull a few strings. It's painful now because it's like a 20p piece of plastic, but it was yellow. And I had it and I was like, I couldn't wait to get on Soccer AM and be wearing my Live Strong thing. So I was like, I'm part of the elite now. You know, I've got one like all the rock stars. And I just remember that being so influential. And I think what it was great about that actual campaign is it represented not only a cancer charity, so you would, there was the virtue signaling, hey, I support the cancer, blah, 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 but also the guy behind it was the most supreme athlete at the time, before we realized he was a cheat in the world. And so it represented so much to be part of the yellow band thing. I really remember wanting it badly. That's weird, isn't it?
It's a really interesting example of what can be a status signifier. It doesn't have to be an incredibly expensive car. It doesn't have to be a house on the right street. It doesn't have to be a particular fashion brand. Like, we imbue certain things with such value, even if it is, like you say, that 20p piece of plastic.
Yeah, and I suppose these days as well, with because that was before social media. With social media now, a lot of your signaling is via social media. So you're spending a lot of time going, here's my flag of whatever nation's just had a problem, and and you're putting that up there saying, I have empathy for the world, or whatever it is that you care about. They said politically adrift or something on their profile. I thought it was interesting. Politically homeless. And I just thought, I'd not read that before. And I read it and I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting, because that's kind of most of us at the moment. I thought, well, a lot of people I know are like, oh, I'm not in any of the camps. And so, I thought that was an interesting way of signaling.
It's really interesting. It's a challenge for a lot of my clients, because I work with a big range of people. I work with charities. I work with big global corporations, and quite often work with companies trying to sell stuff to people and trying to work out what the future of their market is. And you take cars, for example. I'm just embarking on a new project on the future of cars, and particularly what we as consumers want from a future car. And your cars kind of lost a lot of their cachet as a status symbol. You know, it used to be such an important market in your life to learn to drive, to get hold of a car or some form of transport. It gave you freedom. It gave you status. And that's kind of drifted out of fashion a lot. It's not gone. Obviously, it's still an incredibly useful thing for a lot of people to have. Our cities and our, frankly, our countries built around access to a car. But it had lost a lot of its cachet. And it's really interesting how it started to come back, actually, with EVs, and particularly with certain brands of EVs. They've got that, just like your bracelet had that combination of, it connects me to this athlete and, you know, it's showing my virtue because I'm supporting this charity. You know, particular brands of EV, like notably Tesla, you know, has connected people to, until at least yesterday, a character that lots of people wanted to be seen close to, and showed that they are, you know, green, and has this sort of status effect of being very expensive.
Yeah, and living in the future, which I always think we want to do. I'm at the forefront of technology here with my Tesla. I've got a e-car. I hardly use it though, because I've got an e-bike as well, which I use a lot more, but and I use the tube. It's just London has become gridlocked. So the idea of getting into a car in London is just, to me, it's absolutely pointless. I walk, cycle, or get the public transport absolutely everywhere. And I can't believe some of my friends are still driving. I'm like, why? Are you getting in? You're just in a traffic jam constantly.
And parking's such a pain.
Yeah, it's the whole thing is just so stupid to drive around in London. But I live in London. I suppose if you're commuting in, it's a different thing. So what have you been working on recently? Anything exciting?
Yeah, lots, actually. I've been doing some work with, and I haven't got approval to name them yet, but let's call them the biggest AI company in the world, on some of the big challenges that AI might be useful to tackle. And how they might approach that was really interesting, using this framework of saying the near future is defined by the challenges we can measure and see today mapped against the trends we can see coming in tomorrow. And if AI is the trend, then where does AI map up against the big challenges that we're facing today, and how might we use it to solve them? That was a fascinating project and informed a lot of stuff I'm doing. And I've just been working with one of the big car hire companies as well, actually. It's funny because they don't just provide cars to people like you and me. They provide things like all the vehicles you see airside at the airport, and, you know, diggers for construction sites and generators and trucks, you know, all this stuff, all of which is going electric in the next 10 years or next 10 to 15 years, certainly. And so they've got this, you know, trying to explore with them how you get there. How do you get to net zero if what you're basically doing is running a huge fleet of vehicles that right now run on petrol or diesel, and which right now there are no good alternatives for? I mean, literally, you can't buy an electric alternative for most of their fleets for what they're doing because of the range or the power, or because no one's built that specialist vehicle yet. And so exploring that's been really interesting as well.
Do you know what? We've talked about this before, but I've noticing it more and more. I sort of became obsessed with it, the rental market. Do you remember ages ago, I'd play Dragon's Den with my daughters, and I came up with this concept where you rent a life. You give them a certain sum of money, then they supply your life with everything. And that was kind of, and I'm sort of seeing, not saying that I predicted the future there, because I'm sure a lot of people, but when I first started out renting flats, we rented TVs and stuff. And then obviously we end up buying them because they were cheaper. And I'm wondering if we're going back that way. But I've noticed recently interesting things like children's trainers is one. So you pay a subscription and you get trainers. Wow. And it's been running on the tube. And children's bikes is another one, because they grow out of them so quickly. So anything in that children's market where parents go, right, rather than keep buying new ones, I'll pay a certain sum of money, a subscription fee. But it's great for the subscription companies because they're locking you in with a subscription. If we get to the thing that I'm going to ask you to invest in, Tom, which is rent a life, which we're going to do one day. Once we got people subscribed to, and we're giving them their chairs and their clothes and everything else and their transport, they can't get rid of it because they're into us for the subscription, you know. It's going to be brilliant, Tom. We're going to be billionaires.
But you can see it working. I mean, there's a really good green angle to this, which is we a lot of the stuff we buy, we don't use very much. And so it sits in a drawer or in a cupboard or in a shed much better than it's getting used a lot. And technology made it easier to take the friction out of sharing stuff. You know, you could share it across more people. You could manage it, build people, all that with technology, easier than having bunches of bits of paper floating around, etc. But like you say, you're kind of locked in then. You've got no sort of freedom. You've not got any assets. You don't own anything. And the place I'm really seeing this, and it's kind of the closest thing to your rent-a-life concept, is the build-to-rent market. So, you know, you're getting these basically like an extension of university campuses. If you go to university in your first year, particularly, you go into halls and you pay one bill and everything's covered. You get your broadband, you know, you get your water, you get your electricity. You don't have to think about anything. You probably, whether you get insurance or not, I don't know these days, but everything's covered right with one bill. And now when you're in your 20s and you go off into the sort of world of work and move out, you can do the same. You pay one bill. You don't have to think about negotiating broadband fees or who's the best energy supplier or anything else. It's one bill. And you're effectively renting that life, quite possibly in a partially furnished place. So you're getting the chair. You probably bring your own telly right now, but it can absolutely see you extend that model. And you go, do you know what? We'll just take care of everything. And it's 500 quid a month, £1,000 a month, £2,000 a month, whatever it may be. And here's your life.
Yeah,
that's we'll even it. Fill the wardrobe.
Yeah, that's it. You pick a price and we'll give it. And then every now and then, because a lot of the rental clothes stuff is happening now, I'm seeing more influencers on social media all the time saying, I rented a dress. I did that because people like it, don't they? Again, it's one of the ways of signaling. It's your yellow band that your Live Strong band saying, I'm renting. I'm rather than buying. I'm really good. I see, by the way, Nike and Adidas, they both are obsessively talking about recycling their trainers. So they're clearly wanting to do it. Not only do they recycle them, as in they take trainers which you can trade in your old trainers and stuff, especially in the kids market, but they're also I think it's Nike who take them all apart, the rubber, and they put them in running tracks, or they recycle them and make them into new trainers. So you're often buying a pair of trainers these days which is made of old recycled trainers. And I was in Maharishi the other day and I saw this hat. And the guy, a fluffy hat, and the guy goes, oh, that fluffy hat's made of recycled bottles. And I'm like, wow. And I was like, oh, I want that then, because it's, you know, anything like that, it appeals to me. And they know that because I want to be part of the recycling generation, because it makes sense to me. That's the thing. That's the big thing about it. It makes sense. So, Tom, tell us about this course then, because I think it's such a great idea. I'd love to understand how you produce the magic to work out the future.
I mean, so it starts from the fact that I'm really busy. I'm very pleased to say, and it's a difficult thing to say because the worse the world gets, the more uncertainty and disruption there is. The busier futurists get, because people are looking to cling on to something certain. They're looking for some insight, some understanding, a way to get a grip on what's happening and try not to be sort of swept away by the waves of change. And so I get really busy, and the more busier I get, the more people ask, well, how do you do what you do? You know, can I do it? Could we have our own in-house futurist? Could it be my career? Someone literally emailed me this morning saying, from Canada, saying, you know, I've been an engineer all my life. I've done lots and lots of sort of planning and strategy stuff. I'd really like to actually get into being a futurist full time. How do I do it? And so, you know, I wrote a book about this a couple of years ago and tried to sort of capture as much of the process in a book. But sometimes people need a bit more than that. They want to actually get a sense of it. They want to try it out, particularly in a room full of like friendly people before they put it out there and call themselves a futurist on LinkedIn and start, you know, sort of taking gigs. And so I put this course together. And I've been teaching people one-to-one and in small groups behind closed doors for years. But a company came to me and said, why don't we put the course online? And, you know, then you can reach people all around the world and they can learn at their own pace and come and sort of, you know, learn all this stuff, learn all these modes of thinking. And so that's what we do. We teach, first of all, like different ways of thinking about the future, particularly different time frames. Because it's one thing to think about the next 5 years. It's a completely different thing to think about the next 25 years. And you use different techniques, different methods to kind of explore those possibilities. And then we talk about storytelling. And storytelling is a huge part of futurism because you're trying to get people to imagine something with which they're not familiar. You've got to get people to take the blinkers off, forget about the day-to-day, get out of their email, get out of their, you know, their phone messages and social media and actually think differently. And so we do a whole chunk on storytelling as well, about how to tell stories about the future.
So that's you telling a company or you telling yourself. Which way around is it?
I mean, you can be telling yourself, but most often it's about, you know, the futurism has to have a value. It's why I talk about applied futurism, because, you know, unapplied futurism is sci-fi, really. It's writing science fiction books, which, you know, would be great fun. Mm-hmm. And I've actually just had my first commission to write a few short sci-fi stories for a client, which is great. But, you know, I'm not necessarily changing anything there. Whereas most of the time when people come and commission me, they want change to happen off the back of it. They want me to tell their board about what they need to do next or where they should be investing. They want me to tell their customers about where their market's changing and why they're going to be changing what they do. And so it's really about telling that story to other people and compelling change in them. But yeah, absolutely. You know, sometimes it's just about getting your own head out of the day-to-day and thinking about the future differently.
So is it a course for, is it a course to actually get a career in it, or is it just a course you can just do just to get intrigued by the future? Can you do it that way as well?
Yeah, absolutely. You could do it just because you want to think a bit differently. And I think most people doing it, you know, what most people don't realize, I think, often is that there's a budget in their business. There's a budget in their office. Somebody at their work is sat on thousands of pounds that they can spend on training. And it's about finding that person and going, I really want to do this course. Can I have, right, you know, however much money to do it? And so most of the people doing it will be doing it to advance their careers. They've hit a rut maybe, or they've hit some problems they couldn't solve, or they just fancy a bit of a change of direction and something a bit different. But you know what? If you just want to explore it, absolutely. And some of the people who contact me, it's just about, I want to think differently. I want to think differently about this. How do I do it?
What I will say is, like, Tom's life looks quite glamorous with his roller skating and his building cars and his building computers and everything else he does, which is quite sad. But what I also say is, to get to the level that Tom's at of this, it is bloody hard work, because you've got to be across a lot of stuff, haven't you? So it's like anything; it's not easy to do. There's a lot of research involved in your job, isn't there?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you have to be quite mercenary. You know, I'd love to stay across everything all the time. But what actually happens is a project comes in and that, you know, they come in one after the other quite quickly. And so you have to turn direction 180 degrees and go and learn about something completely new. And it's why having a methodology is important, because I couldn't just do this in the abstract. I couldn't go, right, I'm going to be an expert on energy tomorrow. I need to have a way of thinking about it. I need to know what to look at, where to get the information, and how to digest that information into useful form. And so, like I say, you know, in the last, you know, 2 weeks, I've done AI, I've done, you know, cars, I've done tomorrow, Thursday, you know, a couple of days from me now, I'm speaking to you know, a bunch of manufacturers about the future of their sector and what's going on there. So you're constantly bouncing between different industries, different sectors. And sometimes some things are common. There are some big macro trends that touch everything. But you absolutely have to be expert enough in their field to be credible. And I always try and have this sort of rule of thirds when I go and talk to a new audience. I always try and about a third of my presentation or my talk or my report, whatever it may be, should be things they already know. Because what I'm trying to do is give them a sense that I know their world, that I know what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. And I'm almost sort of playing back to them things they've told me about what's really concerning them or where they see the world going. And then about a third of it is things that are just on the periphery of their knowledge. It's things that they sort of know, or maybe they had an inkling about, or they've heard but not really explored. And I do the exploration for them. I flesh out their knowledge about stuff that's at the edge of their vision. And then the third is completely new stuff. It's the mind-boggling stuff that they've never considered. And this is particularly when you start to smash together those existing pressures that they understand with the incoming trends that maybe they hadn't seen. And so once you've done that credibility piece, you've given them a third of stuff they know, and he's like, okay, yeah, he understands our world. And a third, like, oh, I hadn't thought about it like that. Then you can go a third, wow, I never saw that coming. And they always leave most excited by that, but you've got to do the other two bits first.
What do you mean by a different way of thinking? Can you give us like a sort of a bit of an example of a different way of thinking to become a futurist?
Yeah, I mean, it's not rocket science or brain surgery or any one of those analogies. It's really quite simple in some ways, but we don't do it very much. We don't spend very much time thinking in a structured way about the future. We tend to deal with what's next, what's on our plate. We're constantly firefighting, particularly when you're at work. You're always dealing with what's next or what problems next. And so the first thing is to actually carve out the time. It's saying, can you carve out, and I say to my clients, 1% of your time. Can you get one day every 6 months where you turn off email, you're not in any meetings, you're just focused on the future? And then it's about looking for two different things. It's about asking a bunch of questions that uncover the pressures that are there today. So I ask people, what frustrates you? What winds you up? What stops you being as productive or as happy as you could be? What's getting in the way? And then I tell them to go and ask the questions to their colleagues or their customers or their friends and family. You go and get a sense of what those pressures are. And then it's about saying, well, okay, what's happening outside of my sphere? Where can I look to go and find things that I don't know about? So what's happening in South Korea? What's happening in China? What's happening in industries that aren't mine that look a bit like mine? If I'm an accountant, what are lawyers doing and vice versa? What's happening in, you know, cool corners of the internet that I don't explore very often? You know, what's, you know, why don't I go and spend an hour on TikTok and see what trends I can pick up? What's happening in fashion?
No, it's addictive. Don't do that.
Yeah.
You'll never get off it again. But, you know, it's about that. It's about giving people a sort of set of structured prompts, really, to go and get out of the day-to-day and find new information, and then a way of smashing those bits of information together to find conclusions.
I'm fascinated by fashion at the moment, actually, because when I was a kid growing up, the fashion designers, the shows they put on were extraordinary and just really cutting edge, and it all got a bit bland and it all got very samey. And the last few years, I don't know whether it's to do with the pandemic or something, but if you look at like Tom Brown's and people like that, their catwalk shows and stuff, they're extraordinary. They're really like arty again, and it looks like they're spending cash and they're going out. You know, the Balenciaga one the other day where they're walking around a muddy catwalk and everybody, and it's great because people go, oh, well, they're putting clothes in mud, and it's like, so you go, why are they putting clothes in? And they're walking around, and I'm looking at these shows and I'm thinking, wow, fashion's, and I can't quite work out, maybe you know, but why fashion is becoming so, they all looked very much like the same for a while. Now none of them want to look the same. They're all going very individual. Someone told me it was because, and I don't know how true this is, actually fashion is dictated by the street, not the other way around. And because the street went very thrift store, the kids went very much, I'm going to the thrift store and buy my clothes. So the kids started looking individual. And because people want to look individual, they're having to reconsider their look. And not like a few years ago, it was all flight jackets or something. You know, it's like no one does that now. They're all doing way out clothes. So now we want to all look the same by looking different. If you see what I mean, right?
I think that individuality is really important. It's something that I come across a lot in my work. Is this? Yeah, you know, when I was at school, there were two trends, like there were two tribes. There was the indie kids and there was the ravers. And, you know, the indie kids were black Doc Martens, black jeans, German army shirt, band t-shirt, floppy hair. And, you know, the ravers were Reebok Classics, you know, sweatshirt and a bag of tapes, you know, Rat Pack tapes, a bag of rave tapes, you know, and it was, and never the twain shall meet. Whereas now you talk to a group of kids of that age and that doesn't ring true. There isn't two tribes, there's 2,000 tribes. Because they're much more individual and they self-assemble their identities from all over the place. And so you do get that sort of much broader spectrum. Again, it's really hard for brands. Like, how do you, your brands can't just latch onto a trend. You know, they can't just do a video of, you know, break dancing or something and try and pick up all the people into break dancing. Cause it's like, you'd have to do 2,000 different videos for every different niche. But it's, yeah, I think it's very much there. And by the way, I actually went to the launch of, this is very much in line with your fashion thing. I went to the launch of a new exhibition the other night that a friend of mine's curated called About Dandies. It's Manchester Art Gallery. There's a whole exhibition of like the history of men's fashion with photos and clothing and modern designers and all sorts. Gilbert and George were there, the artists, very famous for their matching suits.
I do like, is that what they're famous for? I think they're more famous for standing naked or or doing pictures of, what was it, piss, poo and spunk or something, one of their paintings and stuff. I think they did this thing years ago where they sat and they had a meal with Hockney, I think, when no one cared about them, and they had a meal with him, and they invited 1,000 people and only 13 turned up. And they're thinking about doing it again to see what happens, because, you know, if they do it now, thousands will turn up, I imagine, to watch them just sit and have a meal in a gallery. But they turned themselves into art, didn't they? They were just statues. They were like, I love Gilbert and George. They just fascinate me, because they've been together. What fascinates me more is they're a partnership of in art who have stayed together for all this time. It's absolutely like incredible.
40 years or something, yeah.
I think more than that, you know. I reckon we're knocking on 50 years. It must be. Anyway, so should we go through a few things?
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, my friend who works in fashion, he does a lot of, goes into retail and tries to help their businesses out and stuff. He was the one who told me years ago, he said, the suit is dying, but the tie is dead. He'd gone to a conference where they'd basically said the tie is dead. No one is, like, anyone involved in the tie industry, you're knackered. It's not going to happen anymore, because no one's wearing them. It's like there's so few times, a funeral, a wedding, and, you know, like, everyone used to wear them to work, but the suit is a massive decline. And even in the city, they're not wearing ties, they're wearing just shirts and suits, you know. So that was interesting. He just said to me the other day, what's interesting about all the designer brands, hadn't seen him for ages, he said they've all put their prices up. We've gone into recession or gone into bad times, and they've all put their prices up. I don't know what the thinking behind that is, but that's intriguing. I think it's, if I'm going to wear, I don't know, Prada or Balenciaga or something, I've had to pay a lot of money for this. Basically, they haven't brought their prices down; they've gone up, and it's fascinating that the mind behind that. A pair of trainers now from one of those designer brands, over £1,000 or knocking up towards £1,000 for a pair of trainers. It's just incredible how they're putting that label on it. It's the same materials they're using for Nike and Adidas, and yet they're putting it up there, and people are going, yeah, I like it, because it's got the name on it. It's bizarre. And one other thing, Peter Frankopan, who I interviewed on this podcast, he wrote some great books. The New Silk Roads was the one I talked to him about last. He always tells his kids to make sure that when they're researching, to look in Asia and Africa and all those markets, because when they're looking at music or film, there's more going on. There's more people watching movies in Asia than there ever are Hollywood movies, because the population is all in the Silk Road. It's all down there. We're sparsely populated up here. Down there, they've got billions watching things, you know, or listening to music. And it's, and you know, they're outselling Western stuff by miles. But we're so in our echo chamber up here, aren't we? And just looking at what's happening in the West.
Yeah, and you know, and declining. It was one of the things that we were going to talk about is the population shift. You know, the second half of this century, global population declines, but in some places it's still growing. You mentioned Africa, Nigeria, it has something like five times the birth rate we have here. So we got this what's going to be both an economic, but also importantly, a cultural superpower. You look at how sort of Asian media has come to dominate in the West in terms of, you know, K-pop, in terms of manga, you know, in terms of these sort of these very sort of, you know, particular art forms. Yeah, I think we can see that pendulum swinging towards Africa, towards the second half of the century, as the population balance changes, and you get this sort of really interesting new influx of cuisines, of literature, of music. You know, really, it's going to be a fascinating period. But this period of incredible change for Europe. So, you know, one of the stats that I always shock people with when I'm talking about this is the populations of some countries in Europe are forecast to halve by the end of the century. So you've got places like Italy, because the birth rate's incredibly low, because we've been fairly anti-immigration. And birth rates are declining over the world because basically when we give women the opportunity, they tend to have fewer children. You know, it's why you're starting to see these kind of scary stories floated in the papers now about incentivizing women to have more kids. There was, you know, an anonymous cabinet minister quoted in The Sun last week floating the idea of incentives for people to have more children. It's like, you know, hang on, we've just gone through this massive sort of political disruption, mainly around the idea of immigration. They're being, you know, trying to bring down the numbers of people in the country, and now we're talking about incentivizing people to have kids. Economic measures.
The population in my lifetime, the world population, has doubled. Mm. In this country, I think it's gone up nearly 20 million. Yeah. So how? But now it's going to go a massive decline.
Yeah, second half of this century. Even the most sort of conservative forecasts, and there are some that are very much not conservative. Even the most conservative forecasts see population decline in the second half of this century, and some of it decline a very long way. So we top out in the sort of 2050s, 2060s, depending on which forecast you look at, and then start to decline, basically because of the spread of women's emancipation. When we allow people, allow women, more choice, given the opportunity to work and access to education, people tend to have fewer children.
Isn't it a good thing though? I mean, like, yes. we always feel the planet's overpopulated anyway, and we're using too much of its natural resources and everything else. It's nice that it's much better that women are equal and have choices.
The latter one of those two is very much the problem. It's not so much that there's too many people, there's too many people using too much stuff. We could support a very large population if we were all a little bit more, and I say that, tongue in cheek, frugal. Absolutely, it's a really good thing. But the challenge as ever is the transition. The challenge is not the fact that we end up with a smaller population. That's great. The challenge is what happens while we get there. So you look at, what happens to the tax base when you've got, a third. Well, in some parts of the UK, we're going to have a third and maybe even ultimately half the people of retirement age in an area, particularly some of the sort of the coastal towns in the south. You're going to have half the population of over retirement age, certainly the current retirement age. That's tricky economically. It's tricky in terms of care and health. It's tricky in terms of sort of culture, and it's tricky politically. People later in life tend to vote more right wing. It presents all sorts of challenges. And in the UK, we're far from the most dramatic. Like I say, there are other countries where the population is going to drop off very sharply. And you look at somewhere like Italy, which has just elected a pretty right-wing government. They're not going to be incentivizing immigration anytime soon to offset this effect. They're going to be cutting back on it and largely closing borders, I suspect. So it may even accelerate the decline of the population there.
If Liz Truss is still PM, what she'll do is she'll give a tax break for the multimillionaires and billionaires, and then she'll tax the OAPs who are in their retirement. Oh, a little bit of politics, Tom.
Yeah. If you want to do something progressive, make childcare cheaper. People are very rational about how many kids they have.
The biggest thing I think with politicians, and I know I've said this to you before, but it's so what they all seem to be missing the point of is the public don't have the money anymore. The money is stuck in companies from globalization, and we're trying to still take money from the people who just don't have it. They just don't have the lion's share of the cash. And we know that. We can see the wages in real terms have gone down, and we can see that nurses and policemen and firefighters and stuff are in poverty, knocking on the door of poverty. It's really hard for them to have kids, even if we wanted them to have bloody kids, because the money has gone to less people. And so we need to somehow realize this, that things have changed, but they still seem to be going down exactly the same route, thinking that we as the public or the population, we have all the money. We don't. It's changed. And I think that's where they're missing the point. I mean, am I being too stupid there?
No, not at all. When I talk to business leaders, in many ways, so you saw this in the comments pages of the FT after the announcement of the cut of the 45p tax rate. Most of the comments were, this is ridiculous. I'd much rather pay the tax and have a functioning infrastructure.
Yes.
And people feel the same at a corporate level. But they inevitably feel like they also must go through the motions to minimise their tax bill. They don't feel like they're doing their job if they're not paying a lawyer or an accountant to try and minimise their tax bill. I think the surprise comes that how relatively toothless governments have been at pushing back. There are now some global efforts to harmonize corporation tax, because I confess it's not easy for one country to unilaterally put up corporation tax, because the argument is that people will just go elsewhere, and frankly our relatively lax legal systems when it comes to this mean that companies can go and trade from elsewhere, and companies have been doing it in the UK for years, paying lower tax rates in Ireland or wherever else while trading into the UK. And you need a bit of cooperation with other countries in order to offset that. It's coming, but it's come way more slowly than would, you know, is healthy for the country and, the, and our investment in infrastructure. And I think actually way more slowly than I think corporations thought it would. I think, you know, I think genuinely think a lot of companies and CEOs would welcome a higher tax bill if that money was going on improving infrastructure, which in many ways is failing. We were talking about potentially rolling blackouts over winter.
Do you know what? It's funny, you did, just to interrupt you there, the podcast I did a few weeks ago with Robert Kerchak, we were talking about that exact thing, that, you know, what people are annoyed about is they pay their taxes. Where's it going? People don't mind paying high taxes if they can see it's going back into the infrastructure and it's going on the right things. And that's always a worry. Yeah. So let's go on to, we've arrived in the 70s again. We've got power carts. We're going to probably have rubbish piled up on the streets. People are striking. Which is, you know, all these things are sort of understandable, and we've got energy is a very high cost. What is happening out there with the energy and everything else which is happening?
So, I mean, I get to feel a bit smug at this point because I wrote a report back in 2015 that we published in 2016, you know, highlighting that we'd underinvested in new energy infrastructure, we didn't have the generating capacity we needed, that we were massively over reliant on gas from Eastern Europe and from Russia. And that we really needed to do something about this. And inevitably, we didn't really do anything about it. We haven't built any new nuclear. We remained very, you know, our energy strategy remained very reliant on gas. We did build a lot of wind, but not a lot of storage. We removed the incentives for solar. And now we've got, you know, Tory MPs celebrating that they've blocked another solar farm in the countryside purely on aesthetic grounds, completely ignoring, you know, the energy prices and the challenge facing us from a climate change perspective. So yeah, we've kind of, you know, dug our own grave a little bit with regards to energy. And what's happening now, my big concern is that, you know, I think we will get to net zero. I think we will make the energy transition. We will move to largely renewables. The problem is that because it hasn't been led by government, because it hasn't been led properly strategically, it's individuals and companies that are pushing it. So if you can afford to, you are putting solar panels on your roof. If you've got the opportunity, you can afford to. You're putting solar panels on your roof. You're putting batteries in your basement because you see these headlines about rolling blackouts. You know, your energy bill's just gone from 150 quid to 400 and potentially up to, you know, up higher than that. And you're looking at the cost of solar panels and you're going, well, yeah, do you know what? If I can generate and store my own energy, brilliant, you know. That's great for you. Your next door neighbour or, you know, the flats next door aren't going to do that. They haven't got the cash to do it. The landlord's not going to do it. All of a sudden, the cost of that shared energy infrastructure is spread across fewer people. And so the costs go up further for them effectively. And, you know, I think the biggest concern around energy for me at the moment is that it increases inequality, that actually it drives a further wedge between haves and have-nots. Over the next few years. I'm a rational human being. I've just done it. We've just had solar panels put on the roof. I've got, you know, a load of batteries coming in later this month. I'll be effectively self-sufficient for electricity and ultimately come off gas as well. But I know the guys and the three guys who live in the flats next door aren't going to be able to do that.
God, you made me feel really crap because I thought I was doing the right thing by getting so I've got solar installed here because I thought, look, I've got the money, you know, enough to do it. I'll do it, and you know, I like the idea of living with solar energy, and I thought it was good for the environment. And now you've made me feel like
you're doing the right thing. We're doing the right thing, but in the absence of real strategic leadership,
That's terrible, isn't it?
I was recording a podcast this morning with a client about this, you know, this idea of the just transition. You know, we're going to go through these massive changes over the next 30 years. And it's all well and good, you know, cutting our greenhouse gas emissions and, you know, doing what we need to around carbon and reducing particulates and, you know, improving clean water, everything else. But if we absolutely destroy a load of people's jobs in the process, you know, if we leave a load of people in poverty and unable to afford energy and, you know, cook food, heat their homes, buy food in the process, then, yeah, you know, what have we really done? And you know, the guy I was speaking to this morning gave the example of the coal mining industry in South Wales. You know, it was a good thing we stopped digging coal But we did it in an incredibly ill-thought-out, ill-planned fashion. And, you know, in his words, you know, we lost a generation to poverty. And there's a potential. There's the potential that we do that on a global scale as we do this transition. So we have to. While we absolutely have to do everything we can, we should be buying solar, but we have. It has to be a just transition that makes sure we don't, you know, leave a load of people behind in the process.
In support of me putting my solar in, though, so I put it on, and then all of my mates were going, "What's it like?" And I go, "It's just amazing. You know, I'm getting powered by the sun. It's just amazing. I can't believe it." And then my neighbours all saw me do it, and they all came out and went, "Give us the number, we want to do it." And interestingly, a friend of mine who's a property developer, she does flats, buys buildings and does flats, she's put solar on all hers, and she's put those
water butts.
Water butts. She put them everywhere. And I said, and she said, because the people who want to move in want this stuff now. It's become, people want it. And so I think it's moving in the direction. You're sort of looking at a flat and you're thinking, that one's got solar and water butts, that one's not, you're going to probably choose that. So she's doing it for the reason of financial incentive. But it's good that we're moving that way, because if we're moving that way, then surely we're going to start putting pressure on the government to go, you know, why aren't the trains solar powered, and why aren't this happening, why aren't the buses all solar now? And I don't know if they are or not, but, you know, why isn't everything electric and solar run and everything else? So hopefully you'd think we're moving in the right direction.
Yeah, I mean, you'd think, wouldn't you? You wouldn't know it to look at the current government.
Yeah, I think we're lost a bit at the moment, because I think we're just on such power struggles in politics. It seems it's all about power and not about foresight. So it's very hard for them to plan for the future, because all they're looking for is how they can hold on to power at the moment. And it's not looking good for, say, the Tory party at the moment. I know I'm not going to get involved in politics, can I? Keep doing it. And I hate myself for it. But it just seems that there's just a power. I'm not on team anyone, by the way, everybody. I'm what am I? Politically homeless. That's what I am. So there you go. Let's talk about what should we talk about? Cultural fracture. Yeah, that was something. Oh no, let's talk about physical versus digital. Yeah. That really intrigues me, actually, because you were talking to me a bit about this the other day via email. So tell us about that.
There's this funny phenomenon where the more things go digital, the more we crave the physical. And this just keeps coming up everywhere I look. It doesn't matter if I'm working in the food industry. It doesn't matter if I'm working in the leisure industry. It doesn't matter if I'm working in banking. It keeps coming up. And so, you know, the dominant interface for so much of our lives now is the internet, one way or another. You know, it's the way you and I are doing this. It's the way I've done most of my work today. It's the way I do my banking, the way I do my shopping, the way I do everything. And yet, the more I do that, the more I'm like, I need to get out. I need to go and get my hands on something real and do something physical. Like lunchtime today, I was outside cutting the hedge back, and it was great because it was a break from a screen. I'd, you know, not a particularly exciting job. I've left it really way too late because it's boring. But actually going and do something physical and real and visceral was fantastic. And I can see this trend sort of accelerating over the next few years. And sometimes it hits ridiculous peaks. So yeah, the two ridiculous peaks in lockdown for me were 25% of us took up hiking, apparently. Mm-hmm. 25%. And you could see that. Yeah, everywhere we went to one of our favourite walks, it was just suddenly full of people. And we bought something like 3 million pets. And, you know, all of the cat homes and dog homes and rescue charities are now feeling the after effects of that. You know, pets everywhere and lots of people being prosecuted for illegal breeding and things.
So my local park was like a training ground during lockdown for dogs training school. Everywhere you went, there was people trying to train their puppies. It was just like, it was insane. I was thinking, what happens when all this lot go back to work? Good jobs for dog walkers. But the problem is, we all know dogs don't want to be left on their own. Cats don't even like being left on their own. They can barely handle it. Dogs hate it. And I was like, what happens to all these people what happens to all the dogs when the people go back to work? And I'm sure there's a lot of unhappy dogs out there now.
I'd love to do a sort of filtered search on this, but I keep seeing on my social media feed dogs having destroyed rooms. And it's always been there, but I think I'm seeing a lot more of them now because there are a lot more dogs being left alone for the first time and just going nuts, you know, just having no sort of control. But yeah, you start thinking about like what's next, you know, as we make the next big technology transition, which is probably going to be from handset to headset. I was reading some really interesting stuff about Google Glass and why that failed this morning. But, you know, I do think we're going to end up in the metaverse where most of us spend most of our days looking through a pair of lenses of some description at a world that's half real and half virtual. And though, so how much does our craving for the real increase again when we're spending all of this time in a world that's a mixture of physical and digital? And I think our craving for the physical is going to go through the roof. I think we're going to see a real like resurgence in extreme sports. I think we'll probably see a resurgence of meat, actually. I think like that'll be a real sort of meat craving. It'll be a niche and it'll be expensive, like your Balenciaga trainers, but it'll be a real like, you know, thing to do to go and eat some real meat, not lab grown or 3D printed.
Yeah, I wonder if it's going to be generational. Tom, you and me remember a very physical world. You know, if you want to listen to music, you had to actually put something on a turntable or a cassette or eventually a CD. Whereas our kids are just streaming, and my kids are 20. They don't really remember it as much. I crave the real world, and I get so frustrated. I'm really rejecting a lot of. A lot of things now. So social media is really boring the hell out of me now. I know we have to sort of do it for our careers, but I find people's comments, like opinions, I find really boring now. I don't, if you give me some news, I'm fine. If you give me an opinion, fuck off. Excuse my language. I'm not interested in your opinions anymore. So I'm getting to that stage now that I'm unfollowing anyone with an opinion. Anyone who's giving me news. People who give me news, like you, give me news. So I'll follow you. You give me an opinion, I'm not interested. You know, it's a very different thing for me. I'm just not interested in people. People are too opinionated. But when it comes to extreme sport, and by the way, I think social media is really slowing down. I really do. Not on TikTok, obviously. That's speeding up because people want that obsession. But the opinion style Twitter really is. We've all said it in our industry. You used to tweet, you'd get whatever you tweet, any crap you tweeted. Oh look, there's a dog poo. You'd get 1,000, 100 people, 200 people go. Oh, I saw a dog poo as well. But nowadays, you could put something really poignant out there. Unless it's really opinionated, you're not going to get the same reaction you used to get anymore. Do you find that or not?
Yeah. Well, there's just so much stuff, isn't there? Partly, it's just dilution. You know, it's when everyone's connected, when it's so low friction to share something. I wrote a piece a few years ago about, I do remember which celebrity, I'm not going to say them in case I get some of the details wrong and end up getting sued, but a celebrity had got themselves in hot water by tweeting something about an ongoing court case.
Right.
And I said, you know, it wouldn't have happened 10 years earlier because there would have been enough steps in the way, there would have been enough friction that meant that what she said wouldn't have made it into the public because enough people or enough time would have passed. You would have had those sort of 10 deep breaths before sharing it. Whereas now there's so little friction involved in sharing stuff that we just share kind of everything and everyone's sharing everything. And it turns out that a lot of people are actually quite witty and a lot of people are actually can be quite compelling. And so, you know, unless you've got an established audience or unless you're doing this like religiously 100 times a day to really build an audience, it just gets lost. It just gets lost in the ether.
I feel sorry for people who get trapped. They do 3 or 4 good tweets or Instagram posts and then they're funny and people like them and then they're trapped forever. Oh, God, I've got to think of one of these every day. You know, whatever crap it is they're coming up with. And you see a lot with celebrities as well who start doing it and then can't get out of it. I'm doing this thing, right? And people like it, so I've got to keep doing the thing. And I've got so many examples in my head, but I'm not going to do it because they're people I know, so I'm going to do it. Just going back to extreme sports, you say, you're the expert here. I'm not the expert, but I cannot see that coming to fruition. And the reason why is I can see the meat. I get that. I can visualize that. It seems to me that as soon as you walk out your front door these days, you're being bombarded with laws. I mean, there was even people the other day going, let's put license plates on bikes. You're thinking, what? So my 5-year-old kid suddenly has to, or my 9-year-old kid suddenly has to, and then if he swaps the bike or she swaps the, they've got to have a license. I mean, it's absolute insanity that people are thinking that. And then you've got you know, everywhere you go, you've got cameras and rules and laws. And we're going to get to the stage soon where it's illegal to jaywalk like it is in America and all that sort of stuff. So there's more and more and more laws going in place. There's more people scared of, like, rugby's got no future, by the way, literally no future, apart from a very few amount of people who play club rugby and parents who will be perceived as being reckless by letting their kids play rugby. Mm. By the way, full contact rugby I'm talking about, touch rugby will be huge because I think it's a great sport. And I think people will carry on doing it. But to actually get to the level of playing proper rugby, I think they're going to struggle. There's too many. There was another survey recently, wasn't there, where all the ex-players are saying they've got some form of brain degeneration. And so it's not, parents are not going to allow that. Football is going to struggle with the heading. And that is going to, I mean, I know in local football around my way, they're having to vote on whether kids are allowed up to the age of, under the age of 14 now, whether they can head the ball or not. Wow. So they're trying to, yeah, so I can't see how they're going to do it. Now, you've got MMA competitions everywhere. What happens when these kids start going, I entered an MMA competition, I'm 18, but I've got a broken spine or I've got dementia or something. Who are they going to do? They're going to start suing the organizations. If that stuff's going to have to go underground. You know, I want to take up roller skating. They're going to go, all right, but you've got to wear a crash helmet, high vis, you know, da 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 da. I actually see snowboarding, skiing in ski resorts and stuff like that. You're going to have to sign waivers before. I suppose you already do, won't you, when you buy your pass, probably. But it's going to get less and less and less because people are going to get more injured and more suing. And I don't know. I can't see it.
I think there has to be a bit of a backlash against this at some point. I mean, your snowboarding is a good example. No one wore a helmet when I was a kid. Like, no one wore a helmet. And now everyone wears a helmet. Yeah, I don't go very often. I haven't been for years now. But the last time I went, I was the only person in our group who didn't own a helmet. So I went out and bought one.
That's stupid not to wear a helmet.
Yeah, but you just didn't. I mean, it just wasn't something you did.
Exactly,
But the one that really strikes me now is tree climbing. Like my kids climb trees. They're very good at it. And they'll shoot and they'll be 20 feet in the air. Yeah. And other parents, and actually mostly not parents, but other adults audibly tut and get a bit fruity about the fact that your kids are climbing, you're letting your kids climb a tree. Yeah. And I don't think, is there risk? Absolutely. Do you have any chance of living a long, healthy life if you don't take some risks along the way? No, I don't think you do. And I think this is why I think in partly where the craving for the physical and the risk will come from, because we do live incredibly safe lives now. And we can do what we need to do to mitigate that risk, wearing a helmet when snowboarding. But we need it in our lives. We need the thrill. We need the adrenaline. We need the pulse. We need that connection to nature and that connection to our own humanity and physicality. And you only get that when you're pushing yourself and, frankly, when you're taking some risks.
I agree, but I don't believe society's going that way. When I had my daughters in 2002, my twins, there was like two or three things that could kill them when they came home from the hospital. By the time I had Jamie in 2013, I could not believe the paranoia. You know, I was sort of looking at all and the amount of stuff that had ramped up in those 9 years or whatever, it was absolutely incredible. I was like, I'm surprised they let me bring her home because she can die of, you know, suddenly there's thermometers for the bath. It's like, I can tell whether a bath's warm or hot. There's thermometers for a bedroom. There's these motion mattresses. There's like staircase everywhere, like every single thing, and door gates and things on the, it's like there's so many different ways my child can get hurt. And it's like, do you know, if you ever watch a kid, bizarrely, a kid is going to fall down the stairs, by the way, use a staircase. I'm not saying don't use a staircase, but babies, when they walk over to stairs, like, or they crawl over stairs, they turn around immediately and go down backwards. It's the bloody toddlers when you've got rid of the staircase who go hurtling down because they're not watching and stuff. They're the ones who fall when they're eight or something, or they're six or five, you know, when the staircase's gone. But you know, it's like suddenly we're in this world of, can I reiterate, get a staircase. I don't want to get in trouble here. and get a thermometer for your bath and get a motion thing. Get them all. I'm not saying don't do it. I'm just saying it ramped up a lot from the first day. And so this is in every walk of life. It's like, it's don't do this, sign this, do this, you know, high-vis vests everywhere, masks everywhere, goggles everywhere. Yeah, it's I can't see it going the other way. I'm not sure how we get to the stage where we can take it backwards.
Because I think we start to have conversations about the quality of life.
But Tom, I don't think we have a choice, because I think the society and the people who are making the rules. I think if you go to a wherever you go and they say, you know, you turn up and you're not wearing a helmet on a ski resort soon, they'll say you can't ski, and you go, but I want to take a risk, and they go, but we're not allowing that. That's where we get to. Like, for instance, you're not allowed to ride a motorbike without a helmet. That's not going backwards. That's a good risk if you want to take that.
I think that's entirely sensible regulation. But I do think we will react against it. And let's be clear, we are society. We are the people who make the rules.
It's really sensible not to let your kids climb a tree, by the way, even though I let my kids climb a tree. It's much more sensible to say, don't do it. If they're on the ground, they can't fall out of a tree.
You've got to qualify sensible there, because, you know, it's what you're taking away from them if you don't let them. And this is what I mean about this conversation about quality of life. You know, we're going to have a lot of people who live very long lives, and the latter half of their lives are going to be really unhappy. Because they're going to be really unfit. They're going to be obese. They're going to have a variety of health conditions. And we're going to start to look at life very differently. We're going to start to say, okay, would I rather take 20% more risk, have a good chance of being fitter later in life, and risk that, yeah, maybe my life is shorter, but that throughout that life, I have a good appreciation of risk, that I have a greater connection with my own body and with the world around me. And I think people, it's not going to happen overnight. I completely agree. There's so many resisting factors to this. But I absolutely think that we will go back in that direction. Not most of the time. Most of the time we'll live our lives in this very happy, safe bubble.
I normally agree with you on this one. This one, I've just watched the trend go, because it's really frustrating me that we're not allowed to do anything ever. I remember the point where it became really apparent to me was when I was in Scandinavia. I think I was in Sweden or Denmark or somewhere. I think Sweden. And I'm watching all the staff go backwards and forwards in the airports, because obviously airports are big areas and they're all on like pedal scooters, not even electric scooters, pedal scooters. And I went, what a brilliant idea. And I said, well, I wonder why they don't do that in England. And I thought, I know why they don't do that in England, because they'd be scared to be sued. So you've got, you know, you're going to do that in England, you'd have to wear high vis, armbands, you know, elbow and knee pads, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, because they'd be terrified. We've created a culture where everyone's terrified of being sued and everybody's terrified of taking risk. And so I can't ever see it going backwards. I hope you're right, because, you know, I've interviewed Megan Hine on this show, who's her book, great book, Mind of a Survivor. She talks about when she takes kids on expeditions, she's like a adventurous type person. And she says some of them have no motor neuron skills, which is exactly what you're saying. It's like they struggle to walk up rocks, you know, whereas I take my kid out and I let her climb up rocks and climb up trees and go in the sea and do whatever she wants, like you do and like most parents are doing. It could be frowned upon by a lot of people, like you're saying, people in the park going, why is that child up a tree? You know, I don't know. So anyway, well, look, we're going to carry on doing this for the next 20 years. So in 20 years time, we'll see if it's what time scale are you putting on this, Tom, so we can put it to a, you know, see where we're at.
I think you'll see, I think the bit to measure it will be sort of 3 to 4 years after the metaverse becomes a thing. We don't know exactly when that's going to be, because there's a lot of work around design and technology to be resolved. But I think we'll see 3 to 4 years after the metaverse has become a thing, we'll see an exponential growth in that craving for the physical. And that'll be the time to measure it.
So go on. How long before the metaverse, you say? 3 or 4 years? Or is that after?
I think real metaverse is probably still 10 years out. I keep saying it's 10 years. Okay. And it's because, but it's hard to predict, because the biggest challenge is we haven't got a design language for it yet. Like, it can't be the web in front of your face. And it's not going to look like computer games exactly either. And no one knows exactly what it's going to look like yet. And until we crack that, it's going to fail.
So in 2037 we'll have this chat and we'll see where we're at. That's roughly right. Yeah.
2037. I'll call you from the top of a mountain.
Just really quickly, because we've run out of time, so I'd like to keep them out. Our cultural fracture. We were just sort of getting into it before we hit physical versus digital. Let's just do a quick brief on that, because it is quite an interesting thing.
Yeah, well, it comes back to this, what we were talking about individuality. You know, there's no longer these sort of, you know, uniting tribes, and it's a really good thing in most ways. We have this diversity of media, whatever your interests are, whatever you want to watch, whoever you feel connected to, you can find those people online. But at the same time, there's a question of, well, what then unites us? What brings us together? What is the conversation around the water cooler? What's the conversation at the school gates? Do we have a shared set of media, of memes, of ultimately sort of, you know, beliefs and reference points that bring us together? And, you know, I was chatting to the CEO of a big housing association about this, and she was saying that they're really struggling to create a kind of sense of community in some of the big housing developments that they run, because there's just not as much that connects people as they used to be. They used to have a shared religion quite often, or sometimes they'd all be immigrants from the same place. And now they've got this wonderful diversity, but at the same time, this real struggle to build a sense of community and connect people. And we're not doing it necessarily through the media, because, yeah, you know, the same show might trend through Twitter for a day or two, but actually ultimately a fraction of the population's watching it, you know.
I said something really interesting there is during the I think I mentioned this on another podcast, but I take it on a bit, is during the Queen's funeral, when she drove up the A4 and lived where all my community came out, and doesn't matter what sort of race, sex, creed, whatever it was, everyone was out there waving and, you know, not at each other, and it was a real sense of community. And the next day I thought about it a lot, because I really enjoyed it, you know, us all out there on the road, you know, looking at a car going past, basically. And I thought, if we were all Christian, there was a church near me right at the bottom of my road as well, and I said to my friend who's a builder, and I bumped into him, I said, we'd all be there, wouldn't we, every Sunday? Well, not me, I'm Sunday brunch, but, you know, every Christmas Eve and stuff, it'd be a real community. And then I thought, that's why local schools are really important, to sort of bring community together. And then some bloke I talked to at the gym, he's trying to do this thing, and apparently it's happened in maybe Greece it happened in. And he's trying to do this thing where it's called community eating. And what they do is they get a venue and you pay a subscription and you go there every however many times a week you want, and you get a full lovely meal of not a soup kitchen, just really lovely food of, you know, sort of like a fresh organic food, but to feed you and your family. And you pay a subscription. But there, when you're there, all the kids can play with each other, the parents can have a chat and all that sort of stuff. And they're trying to build this community. And he's speaking to a few of the big supermarkets about whether they would give the food at a reasonable rate and sponsor it, blah, 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 blah. And he really believes that's going to work. And I can't quite work out whether that is a good thing or a bad thing, or that work, but I do think we're trying to crave community again.
Yeah, and particularly community that sort of crosses some of those traditional barriers. It's why the school's great, because everybody, like you say, of every different denominations there, and you get a chance to meet different people, parents from different backgrounds, different levels of wealth, everything else. I think a community, you know, that, you know, church used to do that, which was one of the real big benefits. I think it had all sorts of downsides as well, but that was one of the benefits. And I think, you know, any other sort of alternative institutions that do that, I think are at least, you know, good enough to be worth a try.
Do you think it would work, that idea?
I don't know. I think it'd be very dependent on the area that you do it in.
It's got to be a city. Because it is, it's got to have a catchment area, and you should be able to walk there. It's got to have a catchment, enough people to get them there and stuff like that, I suppose. Yeah. Interestingly, just finally on this, I've always thought Top of the Pops is one of the most interesting things when it comes to mixing cultures, and one of the most important things. And you know, nobody knew when they tuned in to watch the Top of the Pops what they were going to be served up, whether it was going to be, you know, the Smiths, the Cure, you know, whoever. In my in my case, it was, you know, I saw the specials on there and I saw Madness and Selector, and I was really into Two Tone because I'd seen them and that's what I wanted to do. I liked the dance music that they were offering, and it became a massive thing in my life. Other people were watching, oh, I don't know, whatever bands it was, Status Quo maybe, or AC/DC or whatever it is. And then you watch it but I knew what they were watching because I was watching it all on Top of the Pops, and it was fascinating. And I think that's a really important thing. Now we don't have that anymore. You know, all these great specialist radio stations, and you can seek out what you want, is not as good, I don't think, as giving everybody a bit of everything.
Yeah, I think it's that loss of the generalist, you know, that loss of the generalist show. It's brilliant in so many ways. I love that if you want to go and nerd out about, you know, building your own electric car, then there's, you know, there's a load of YouTube channels that will cover it. But at the same time, it's much harder to find that sort of generalist show that all members of my family would want to sit down and watch, because we're so used to having things that tailor to our own particular niches.
Exactly, Tom. It's always wonderful talking to you. Now, if people want to go on your course, how do they get involved or to go and look at it?
So the course is at CTG. That's CTG, changingthegameacademy.com. But you can always find details at my website, which is just tomcheesewright.com, or find me on social media at Book of the Future. I'm going to be doing some group courses next year, actually, in London, Birmingham and Manchester, not announced yet. But if you follow me at Book of the Future on Twitter, I'll be announcing those at some point, probably early in the new year.
What, face-to-face physical?
Face-to-face physical. Two-part courses. Yeah,
I'm in. Do I get mates rights? I must get mates rights.
For you, obviously.
Come on, sort me out, Tom. Thanks a lot, mate. Top man.
Cheers, Tim.